This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Carl Thrush, Associate Professor of History at the University of British Columbia. Carl is author of two books, Native Seattle, Memories from the Crossing Over Place, which won the 2007 Washington State Book Award, and Indigenous London, Native Travelers at the Heart of Empire. Carl Thrush is here to discuss the second edition of Native Seattle, published in 2017. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you.
Why did you write Native Seattle? What is your purpose?
Wow, that's a big question to start with. Yeah. Well, I became really interested in graduate school. My interest in Indigenous history goes back further than that, but I became really interested in graduate school in what I saw as kind of a gap in both the scholarly literature and in public awareness about the intersection between Indigenous and urban histories. There was the sense that when one ends, the other begins, that never the twain shall meet, this idea that those two kinds of stories can't really go together, and in fact, they're opposites. And what I found in Seattle, and I think anybody who pays attention living in this place knows that there is a very strong Indigenous presence here, Native American presence here, but nobody had really written about the intersections of those two histories. And to think about how the urban and the Indigenous are really bound up, and they aren't mutually exclusive here. They actually are mutually constitutive. They create each other, and they have done for over 150 years.
What resources did you use in researching the material for Native Seattle?
Anything I could get my hands on is the short answer to that. Doing Indigenous history and doing urban history means that you have to become competent in a lot of different kinds of sources. And so that included everything from engineers' reports dealing with the Lake Washington Ship Canal, which are a little on the dry side, but fascinating for historians, to oral tradition coming from local communities, to archaeology, archaeological reports, to the newspapers. It's a really diverse set of sources. And, you know, going back to graduate school and learning how to access all those different sources, it was a great training in how to do history more generally.
Who were the Indigenous people living in the Seattle area when the European settlers first arrived? And in which areas did they live?
Well, this is the territory of the Duwamish people, and I should probably have started by acknowledging their presence and the presence of other Coast Salish peoples in this region, and also the Musqueam First Nation on whose unceded land I work and live today in Vancouver. So this is the territory of the Duwamish people. And we can think of them as having some real centers throughout the city. Duwamish comes from a word that means inside. And the center of Duwamish territory was down in the sort of Tukwila and Renton area. There were a number of villages through there. But there were also villages and or towns, as I call them, really, in West Seattle, where University Village is today, in Ballard, and so on. And then the most important one in some ways for the book is called Zidzalalich, which is roughly where First and Yesler is today. And that means the little crossing over place. And that became kind of the operative metaphor for the book.
In what ways did Indigenous people in the Seattle area shape development of the city? How key was their presence?
Absolutely key. And this is something that I really try to articulate in the book, that especially up until about the 1870s, so many of the things that were going on in the town of Seattle, because it really was just a town at that point, relied on Indigenous people. So things like the procurement of food, for example, all kinds of labor. So one of the real engines of the local economy in the early years was Henry Yesler's sawmill at First and Yesler. And many of the employees there were Indigenous men. And so we can think about all kinds of ways in which Indigenous labor actually helped build the city. So for example, there was a church woman who founded one of the first churches in Seattle. And she wrote in her memoir, she said, you know, we couldn't have done all the church building we did without an Indigenous woman in our house, doing our laundry, taking care of our children, and so on. So Indigenous women's labor also helped make the city possible. That's at odds with some policies that were put into place when the city was first incorporated in the 1860s. One of the first laws that was passed was that no Indigenous people were allowed to reside within the city limits unless they were put up by and employed by a white person. So there's this real tension in the story there that the city fathers are sort of saying, well, we don't want these people here, but we sure do need them. And that's really true throughout the 1870s.
In what ways did the Indigenous people of Seattle change the Europeans who settled here?
Well, I think the experience of encounter between settlers and Indigenous people created some new identities. And so you see particularly people of the pioneer generation, that sort of first generation of Seattleites, sort of start to almost play Indian in a way. There's a really great example of a daughter of the first founders who writes in early 20th century. She writes about the destruction of her home as Seattle grows in the 1890s and so on, and her home is torn down. And she says, "I find myself asking Chad Quidal Al, where is my home?" And Chad Quidal Al is Dokhlushutsi, the local language for where is my home? So here's a pioneer woman talking about her house being destroyed using an indigenous language. And she's also making reference to the longhouses being destroyed, which were destroyed by her relatives. So there's a strange looping around of settlers taking on kind of an indigenous identity. And we can also really see that in the creation of things like the totem pole as the civic symbol and so on, which of course doesn't come from the Seattle area and has since become kind of a local icon.
How did the indigenous way of life change as a result of European settlement? And what were the challenges for indigenous people?
Profound changes. And the changes are so much more stark in urban places than they are in a lot of other traditional territories. And if we think about, for example, the straightening of the Duwamish River, this was a hugely traumatic event for the ecosystem and for the people who relied on it, as you can imagine. Another good example is the creation of the Lake Washington Ship Canal. When it was opened in 1916, Lake Washington dropped several feet, and the Black River, which used to flow out of the lake through Renton, ceased to exist. And as I said earlier, that was one of the centers for Duwamish people. And so all of these environmental changes made living in kind of traditional ways very, very difficult. And so many Duwamish people had to either relocate to reservations or they stayed in the city and kind of went under the radar.
Would you comment on the relative influence on Seattle of indigenous people from outside of the Seattle area who passed through the city but didn't live here permanently?
Yeah, one of the things that was really important for me with the book was to talk about multiple kinds of Native history in Seattle, and that's why it's histories from the Crossing Over Place, not history from the Crossing Over Place. So there's the history of the local people, the history of Native migrants to the city, and then the history of Indian imagery in the city. And those last two are really closely related. So in the 1890s, Seattle really bets its future on Alaska. And part of what comes out of that is a new civic symbolism, most notably the totem pole. But you see city leaders dressing up in Chilkat blankets from Southeast Alaska during parades and things like this. So there's kind of a regional, almost imperial iconography that emerges out of Seattle's encounter with Alaska. But what that does is it sort of overshadows a longer history of indigenous migration to Seattle. Going back into the 1870s, you have Macaw, New Channels, and other people from as far away as central British Columbia, the coast, coming down here to trade, to work, to bring things back, to participate in their potlatch traditions and so on. So Seattle becomes kind of a nexus, really, in the seasonal rounds of indigenous people from all up and down the coast.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Carl Thrush, Associate Professor of History at the University of British Columbia and author of Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you say that to be urban and to be Native have been considered mutually exclusive, and you mentioned that at the beginning of the interview as well. Would you explain and say more?
Sure. One of the things I've been really interested in my work, and it comes out in both the Seattle book as well as my new book about London, is something I call narrative estrangement. So narrative stories, estrangement, separation between urban and indigenous histories. And these are really treated in popular culture as well as, I would say, in academic scholarship, as though when a city begins, indigenous presence must end somehow. There's a break. There might be a treaty, there might be a battle, and then indigenous people kind of exit stage left and they never show up again. They might show up at Alcatraz in 1969 and they seem to come out of nowhere. And so what I was really interested in was looking at a period between the founding of the city and when there is a general recognition of indigenous presence, if you look at the old local histories of the city, and the period of kind of Native resurgence in the 70s and later. There's this whole middle space in between that nobody had really looked at. And it's really a question of it having been forgotten, because what I did in the research was found indigenous people on the front pages of newspapers, you know, in 1916. The oral traditions that exist, the oral records that exist about presence in the city. and so on. It's all there. It just had been rendered kind of impossible by this idea, this narrative estrangement.
You also mentioned that Indigenous people have been invisible in the Seattle area. Would you also say more about that?
Yeah, it's an overstatement to say that they have been invisible, but there's a real tension between, in Seattle, I would say in American culture and Canadian culture now that I live there, between kind of the imaginary Indian and real Indigenous peoples. And we can see that really clearly in the case of Siat, or Chief Seattle, who is kind of the patron saint of the city in so many ways, the patron saint of environmentalism and so on, and the famous speech that's attributed to him. And there's a real difference between how he's portrayed in popular culture as kind of this doomed noble savage and how he's portrayed in the oral tradition as a really powerful orator, a really astute politician who really did a lot of good work at the treaties. So there's a tension between those two, between the real man and the symbolic figure. And I think that's kind of true for Indigenous peoples in Seattle more generally, is that their symbols have been very visible, but sometimes the real people behind them have been ignored.
How have the stories told about Indigenous people in the Seattle area affected actions? Why do the stories matter?
That's a good question. I think the stories matter because they're the deepest stories of this place. I think in Seattle's culture, I think there is a really strong interest in place, in ideas about place among settler people in Seattle. That was one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that there seems to be this interest in local history and in a sense of place here. Seattle is one of the few cities you move to get closer to nature, for example. And so these are the oldest stories of the place in many ways. And they also suggest, if you're thinking about Indigenous ways of living on the land, they suggest that there are other possibilities in terms of being in this place. And there have been for thousands of years.
To what extent have Indigenous people been overshadowed by Indigenous imagery in Seattle? You referred to that a bit earlier.
Yeah, I mean, a really good example of that is the degree to which, for example, the Chief Seattle speech, you know, it's well known internationally, but the Duwamish tribe, for example, is, as far as the federal government exists, are not Indigenous people. They don't have federal recognition. Of course, they say that's not true. So there's this tension between, again, the symbolic Indigenous person and the living Indigenous communities that are in Seattle today. And then one of the other communities that gets kind of invisibilized in all of this is the urban multi-ethnic Native American community in Seattle, which far outnumbers the Duwamish community, actually. And there, you know, there are thousands of Native people in Seattle today who come from all kinds of tribes from across the U.S. and beyond. And those stories often don't get included. We tend to focus on Chief Seattle. He dies. His daughter lives in the city. She dies in the 1890s. And then the story kind of disappears, maybe until the takeover of Fort Lawton in 1970. But there are just these little blips of Indigenous history.
In what ways have Indigenous traditions and symbols been used to promote Seattle?
Well, the most obvious one there is the totem pole. The first piece of public art in Seattle was a totem pole that was put up in 1899 at the corner of First and Yesler. First and Yesler, again, seems to be kind of ground zero for these stories. And it was a pole that was taken from a Tlingit community in southeast Alaska. It was a mortuary pole. The human remains in it were discarded. It was cut down and it was towed back to Seattle and put up. Again, as a symbol of empire, it actually faces northwest toward Alaska. And so it's a not so subtle symbol of urban empire. And again, that really overshadowed what was happening here locally for the Duwamish and other local Native peoples, who were often seen as inferior to people further up the North Coast and so on by anthropologists and others. There was a lot of racism in the portrayal of local Native people compared to how Native people up north were portrayed.
How has the political influence of Indigenous people in the Seattle area changed over time?
Well, even in the last 10 years since Native Seattle first came out, you can really see an upswing in Indigenous visibility in the city. So, for example, the election of Deborah Juarez to city council. I'm thinking, too, of the difference between the World Trade Organization protests in 1999, where there was relatively little Indigenous presence there, and the recent protests against the oil drills in Puget Sound, you know, here in Seattle's waterfront, and the kayaktivists and so on, and how central the canoes were, and the Indigenous people were leaders in that movement. And so there has been a stronger and stronger and stronger political influence, I would say. And then the tribes who are federally recognized and have influence in the region as well, their power continues to rise.
Would you say a few words about the Duwamish, who you referred to earlier, is not having recognition? So what has been their story in terms of recognition and history?
The recognition story is a long one. It's one that really the Duwamish people should tell themselves. But in general, since the 1970s, there has been a conflict around the presence of Duwamish people in the city and the 7 criteria for federal recognition. And there have been numerous attempts by the Duwamish to achieve federal recognition. They achieved it in the last week of the Clinton administration, and then in the first week of the Bush administration, it was rescinded. And that's a very complicated administrative bureaucratic story in many ways. And there have been decisions since that have ruled against the Duwamish tribe. But one of the things that I think is quite interesting about their story, and I think important to highlight, is the fact that, for example, in the 150th sesquicentennial of Seattle's founding, the Duwamish people were highly visible at historic commemorations and so on. So they have a lot of cultural clout in the city, I would say. And they are rebuilding their traditions, rebuilding the language, and so on, and saying, we are still indigenous, federal recognition or not, we are still here. And that's the message that I hear from them all the time is, we are still here. We didn't go away.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Carl Thrush, Associate Professor of History at the University of British Columbia and author of Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place. How can a better understanding of Native Seattle help give us direction for the future?
That's a really good question. I think there is a struggle in settler society to come to terms with what has happened in these places. Everything from the epidemics that killed so many indigenous people to the landscape transformations that have affected people's lives so dramatically. And I think there's an interest in places like Seattle to try to acknowledge and excavate those histories. And if there's any way to do that, it's often through the archive. And by archive, I mean really broadly defined. I mean, you know, the newspapers, I mean the oral tradition and so on, is to surface those stories, to bring them to the surface, and then let people sort of do what they will with them. One of the interesting things about Native Seattle as a book is that it's kind of had a life without me. And it's been involved in various projects around the city, like the Cheshiyahood Lake Union Trail, Waterlines Project at the Burke Museum, and other projects to acknowledge this history. And I don't have any prescriptions in terms of what we should do with it, but my job is to sort of put the story out there, or put a version of the story out there, and then let people do with it what they will.
How has the indigenous landscape in Seattle changed since the first edition of the book in 2007?
Well, again, I think indigenous people and politics are much more visible 10 years on than they were. The book really ends with 2001, with the 150th anniversary of the founding of the city. And since 2001 and the 16 years since then, I would say indigenous politics really around the world have resurged. There's a really powerful global indigenous rights movement now that you can see in places like Scandinavia. You can see it in Taiwan. You can see it in Standing Rock and so on. And it's finally getting a lot of traction outside of indigenous communities, a lot of more allyship. And you can see that happening in Seattle as well. You see a greater recognition of indigenous artists in the city. I'm thinking of people like Louis Gong, who has the shop in Pike Place Market. I'm thinking of the filmmaker Tracy Rector, who won one of the Stranger Genius Awards recently. There's a growing sense of indigenous voice in this place, which is really exciting. And I feel like my job as a non-indigenous historian is, okay, I've written my story, now I'm going to get out of the way and make sure to profile those people.
To what extent have your perceptions changed in regard to the role and history of indigenous people in Seattle since the first edition of your book?
Well, I would say that the biggest change, and I write about this in the preface to the second edition, is terminology. Back when I wrote the book, the first version of the book, I used the term indigenous in a very limited way, in the sense of indigenous ways of living on the land, hunting, fishing, gathering, and so on. And I said in the book that by the early 20th century, it's impossible almost to be indigenous in the city. You could still be Indian or native in the city, but to be indigenous. And that language has really shifted in the 10 years since. So that's become kind of the umbrella term that you see in academic circles as well as in activist circles, that term indigenous. So I would really change that. I didn't go back and change the main text of the book, but in the preface I do say this is the term I would use now, because the way I used it before closes things down, which is always the danger with indigenous history, is the narrative of extinction.
To what extent is the relationship between the original indigenous people in Seattle and the European settlers the same or different than in other North American cities?
That's a great question. Living in Vancouver for the last 11 or 12 years, I've been able to see a really, in some ways, parallel story, a story of dispossession, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century. And Vancouver's a little different in that it was never ceded by treaty, so it's still technically in indigenous title, so it's unceded. There are reserves within the urban fabric, unlike here in Seattle. But in many ways, it's a very similar story. Vancouver sells itself using indigenous imagery all the time, again, totem poles and things like that. Victoria, British Columbia has a very similar story as well, as do places like Melbourne in Australia. There's a really similar pattern all over the world of these kind of 19th and 20th century cities and what they do to indigenous presence in that space.
Would you say more about why you chose Crossing Over Place as the subtitle to your book?
Yeah, well, Zidzalalich, again, was the community in what's now Pioneer Square. And Zidzalalich means the little crossing over place. And it just seemed like such a powerful metaphor for the city and the different crossings of different kinds of history, the local indigenous history, the indigenous migrants to the city, and the use of indigenous imagery. All these things are crossing and informing each other. And so it just seemed like I wanted a language that emerged from the place. And so in some ways, Zidzalalich is kind of a gift to me as a writer to use as a metaphor for the city as a whole.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, some of what I've wanted it to accomplish, it already has, in the sense of supporting, sort of being an ally, I suppose, that, although it's not my decision to determine whether I'm an ally or not, to indigenous movements in the city, whether it's the Duwamish or other communities in the city. And that's happened. I would say that the piece of the book that I hear feedback most about is the atlas at the back of the book. There are 127 Duwamish indigenous places in the city. And I did that in collaboration with a linguist named Niall Thompson. And I find it's quite common for me to get requests on Facebook from people who have read it and say, I take that atlas all over the city with me now. And it's really changed the way I think about that place. And I often feel like my job as a historian is to try to disorient people. And that's what I wanted this book to do, was disorient people's sense of the city.
Would you like to say a few words about your other book?
Yeah, my other book, which just came out this last fall, is called Indigenous London, Native Travelers at the Center of Empire. And it takes some of the ideas of Native Seattle, taking an urban place and telling its story through indigenous experience and presence, but it does it with the center of empire. And so it looks at 500 years of indigenous travelers from places that became the U.S., New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, and how their presence really transformed the city. So it was an amazing project to work on. It took a long time, but I'm really happy with it, and I would encourage people to take a look at it as well.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I really would encourage people to challenge their own stories of estrangement and extinction, and to challenge the notion of indigenous disappearance or solely stories of dispossession. And there's a concept by the Ojibwe journalist and scholar Gerald Visner, and he uses the term survivance, which is kind of a combination of survival and resistance. And I would encourage readers of this history to lean in that direction towards survivance and learning in ways that they can support that survivance as non-Indigenous readers.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Carl.
Thank you so much.
You are just listening to Carl Thrush, Associate Professor of History at the University of British Columbia, and author of the book Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place, the second edition published in 2017 by the University of Washington Press. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.